Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Our Jackie, Public Claims on a Private Life, by Karen M. Danak. Narrated by Laurel Merlington. Author's Note: Those writing women's history often find that as their subjects age and change, so too do their names. And, as historians know, names matter. A name communicates something fundamental about a person's identity. As I move through each chapter of this book, and as Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis's context and her name evolved, I had to consider the best way to refer to her. I am not interested in referring to Mrs. Onassis, her preferred address at the end of her life, as just Jackie. Using a first name alone is not the standard practice when writing about male subjects, and so, with a few exceptions, I have not done that here. In using the name of her preference, I aim to pay her the respect so many failed to afford her during her lifetime, when they ignored the Onassis surname and continued to call her Jackie Kennedy, or, assuming claim to her, and adopting a familiarity she did not necessarily welcome or return, called her Jackie O, or just Jackie. Refer to the title of this book. In the chapters that follow, I refer to Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis in a number of ways. Before her first marriage, it is easy. She was Jacqueline Bouvier. Afterward, it is more complicated. To avoid confusion, rather than using on its own either of the last names she shared with either of her husbands, when I write about her, I use Mrs. Kennedy or Mrs. Onassis, her full name or her initials. Her husband's names became hers, and in many ways, their influence on her perceived identity lasted well after their unions had ended. But my goal is to privilege J.K.O. as an individual in her own right, to put her at the center of the stories told about her. In navigating what name to use, that has been my priority. Many scholars, as evidenced in the titles of the many texts about the former First Lady, call her Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and I have largely followed that model. Given the regular usage of JFK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and RFK, Robert Francis Kennedy, both of which I have used in this book, I have also employed the use of initials in my discussion of Jacqueline Onassis and other figures who are discussed in this text. JBK, Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy, used for discussions of her life from September 12, 1953 to October 20, 1968. JKO, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, used for discussions of her life from October 20, 1968 on. A.O., Aristotle Onassis. E.R., Eleanor Roosevelt. H.R.C., Hillary Rodham Clinton. C.K., Carolyn Kennedy. Prologue. Becoming a public figure. In a personal essay penned in 1951, 21-year-old Jacqueline Bouvier wrote first about her appearance. I am tall, 5'7", with brown hair, a square face, and eyes so unfortunately far apart that it takes 3 weeks to have a pair of glasses made with the bridge wide enough to fit over my nose. I do not have a sensational figure, but can look slim if I pick the right clothes. Living in New York until she was 13, she had spent her summers in the country. As a child, she had hated dolls, loved horses and dogs, and had skinned knees and braces on my teeth for what must have seemed an interminable length of time to my family. In the room where she was meant to take naps as a child, she instead hopped down from her resting place and plucked copies of Shaw and Chekhov from the shelves, reading them when they were still too old for her, even by her own accounting. In boarding school, she had attempted to become grown up by copying the girls who had callers every Saturday night, Her pass into adulthood came when she learned to smoke in the balcony of the Normandy Theater in New York, and was immediately asked to leave by the usher, who informed young Jacqueline and her friend that other people could not hear the film with so much coughing going on. Vassar, where she spent 2 years, had been fine, but the real turning point had been a junior year in Paris. Of this time, she wrote, "I loved it more than any year of my life." It was during this trip that she evaluated herself critically and learned not to be ashamed of a real hunger for knowledge, something I had always tried to hide. As for hobbies, Bouvier noted that there were none at which she worked constantly, but expressed an interest in art and indicated her love for riding and fox hunting. From this essay, part of her application for Vogue's 1951 Prix de Paris competition, Bouvier emerges as a forthright young woman, self-deprecating in her humor and capable of crafting an intriguing self-portrait. There is evidence of her privilege and her intelligence and her curiosity about the world in which she lived. Indeed, something in her style caught the eye of the prize committee. Bouvier, competing against nearly 1,300 contestants from 225 colleges, emerged the winner of the contest. As her prize, she was offered the opportunity to work 6 months in Vogue's New York offices and 6 months at the Paris headquarters. Even with an articulated aspiration to be a top editor at Condé Nast, Bouvier ultimately turned down the opportunities presented as part of her prize, ostensibly at the behest of her mother, Janet, who had promised Jackie and her sister Lee a European summer vacation and threatened to cancel the trip if Jackie moved forward with the Vogue post. Reading Bouvier's essay and considering her self-assessment, there is much to suggest that Jacqueline Bouvier, as she aged and matured, was likely to dedicate herself to art and culture and writing and travel, even without the Vogue prize to pave the way to such a life. At just 21, she was sharp and funny and self-aware. With the contacts provided by her elite station, she might well have entered into a kind of professional life where her hunger for knowledge could be satiated, even in 1951, when women of a certain standing were not necessarily expected to pursue such a course, and popular wisdom held that those women who did work did so out of necessity rather than any particular drive. Aside from her referenced teenage admiration for girls who had callers at boarding school, the only mention of men in Bouvier's application comes as a list of artists she admired: French poet Charles Baudelaire, Irish writer Oscar Wilde, and Russian ballet impresario Sergei Diaghilev. There is no indication of marital ambition. Indeed, rather than spend her college years searching for a suitor, as many women of her generation did, and as noted in her application, Bouvier spent her junior year in France, having first proven her academic merit to warrant acceptance in Smith College's prestigious program. She took an intensive French course at the University of Grenoble, enrolled in the Sorbonne, and chose to live with the French family rather than reside in the American dormitories. While in Paris, she attended chic French parties and salons. She traveled to the Riviera and Italy, Austria and Germany, the south of France, and finally Scotland and Ireland, visiting museums and historic sites, but also taking stock of a Europe forever changed by World War II and adapting to a new world order. But a life such as that offered by the Prix de Paris, and sampled as part of her study abroad, though possible, was not to be, at least not initially, and not as a fully independent actor. After graduation from George Washington University, where she matriculated after her Parisian semester, Bouvier continued to live with her mother and stepfather just outside Washington, D.C. Following university and a summer of European travel, she entered into and called off an engagement and established herself as the inquiring camera girl at the Washington Times Herald, a post she made into a vaunted feature of the publication. While she had met him in the spring of 1951 at a dinner party hosted by mutual friend Charles Bartlett, it was only after a subsequent meeting in May 1952, again dining at Bartlett's home, that Jacqueline Bouvier began a steady courtship with aspiring senator and sitting Massachusetts Congressman John F. Kennedy. He sometimes called Bouvier from the campaign trail, scheduling dates in advance of his return to Washington. They double-dated with his brother Bobby and sister-in-law Ethel, staying in for dinner and games, or going out to the movies. Indicating the seriousness of his intentions, Kennedy invited Jackie to join him at the family's summer home in Hyannisport, where she got a taste of the slightly madcap Kennedys. After his election, it was she who accompanied him to the inaugural ball. In the spring of 1953, when Bouvier traveled to London on behalf of the Times Herald to cover the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, the two exchanged communication across the Atlantic. He cabled her, "Articles excellent, but you are missed. Love, Jack," and was there to meet her plane when she returned to the United States. Shortly thereafter, the two became engaged, but Bouvier and the Kennedys delayed announcement of the engagement until after the Saturday Evening Post's June 1953 publication proclaiming Kennedy the Senate's gay young bachelor. Once made public, the news scored a headline in the New York Times: "Senator Kennedy to marry in fall. Son of former envoy is fiancé of Miss Jacqueline Bouvier, Newport Society girl." The Times headline, among the first national coverage Bouvier received, presented readers with a sense of opposites attracting. Kennedy was a senator, son of a diplomat, linked to public service, whereas Bouvier was highlighted as society girl, a frivolous title, and one casting Bouvier in the diminutive. He was well known, whereas she was known only in certain circles, designated as elite by the reference to Newport. Hugh Auchincloss, Bouvier's stepfather, owned a summer home there, and it is where she had made her debut. While the Post article suggested that Kennedy was not a natural glad-hander, he had warmed to the necessities of the campaign trail and embraced the public nature of his chosen profession. Jacqueline's desire to delay news of their engagement suggested an early wariness about how the publicity that followed Kennedy might affect her private life. Based on the Kennedy overview provided as part of the Senate's Gay Young Bachelor, readers might assume that with his engagement, Kennedy had added to his team yet another devoted woman who believed he needed looking after. In 1952, the Kennedy women had jettisoned their respective interests in Chicago, New York, and Paris, so that now eldest brother and son John might achieve the collective family goal of a Kennedy man in office. Tease and small talk, and an element of transparency, marked the work they had done to contribute to his senatorial win. Women outside the Kennedy clan willingly had given their time and indicated their devotion to the young man in need of a woman's touch. Jacqueline Bouvier was but one of many women who seemingly wanted to marry John Kennedy. The key difference between Bouvier and other women: she was the one Kennedy wished, or as those less romantically inclined have speculated, was willing to wed. The precise details of Bouvier's background, her interests, education, and elite standing at this point were largely unknown to a curious public who received only bits and pieces of information about the future Mrs. Kennedy in news stories introducing her on the national stage. And to a large degree, her background and any individual interests she might have held were beside the point. As projected by American media, she was the lucky young woman who had won Kennedy's heart. That was what people needed to know about her. In her nationally syndicated article, Patty Simmons speculated, "Those much-publicized 1,000 females to ever 855 males in Washington are probably dying to know how Miss Bouvier went about this business of snagging the town's most eligible bachelor." Simmons suggested it was Bouvier's good looks, combination of status and common touch, and sense of humor that allowed her to stand out. These qualities, Simmons asserted, would also go big with voters, alluding to the political calculation implicit in John Kennedy's selection of a mate. Mainstream expectations would have been that securing a relationship with a man like Kennedy had been Bouvier's goal, and even with reference to Bouvier's education and time in Paris, Simmons's text did nothing to combat that notion. Marriage, most people assumed, was a woman's natural state. A young woman might face warring impulses when it came to personal ambitions versus social and familial expectations, but the widespread sentiment of the post-war period was that a woman's primary desires were to secure a husband, establish a home, and start a family. She would have caught him, not the other way around. Coverage of John Kennedy's fiancée suggested that he was what made her distinct. He could have chosen anyone. Bouvier was special because he had chosen her. In the early 1950s, it was not uncommon to assess a young woman according to the man standing beside her, but copious coverage of Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis, historical and that recently produced, has revealed just how distinct she was in her own right. Where the American public did not know the particulars of Bouvier's background, what she had to gain from the union warrants consideration. She had grown up in a world of wealth and privilege, but without a promised fortune of her own. After Janet Bouvier's 1940 divorce from John Black Jack Bouvier, her means of guaranteeing a secure future was through marriage to millionaire Hugh Auchincloss, Jacqueline Bouvier's conundrum. She was accustomed to a certain standard of living, but her father's money had all but dried up, and because she was an Auchincloss stepchild, her mother's renewed source of income was not hers. Bouvier lived in a time when securing such a standard for herself through a means outside or beyond the confines of marriage was an unlikely prospect. Her most immediate model demonstrated that marriage was the path to wealth and status. It is possible that a pairing with millionaire Kennedy was a means to an end. Regardless of whatever romantic attachment the two had, Kennedy had money, and if Bouvier would have to leave behind an interest in professional writing and publishing, she still would be able to pursue her other interests and ambitions in a private context, and, even more, in contribution to the career of a man she, by all accounts, found exceptional. To Kennedy's benefit, the private interests of Bouvier could be used to enhance the public image he and his team were so dedicated to crafting. As her friend Aileen Bowden said of the period leading into the pair's marriage, this was the turning point for Bouvier, going from private life to public life. Early coverage set a tone for understandings of her public persona. A month after the Saturday Evening Post's celebration of John F. Kennedy's bachelorhood, resulting from a media day orchestrated by the Kennedy family, Life magazine featured John Kennedy and Jacqueline Bouvier on the cover of its July 20, 1953 issue, and offered readers an inside look at courting with a U.S. senator. Photographed on Cape Cod at the Kennedy family compound, John and Jackie are seen together and with the rest of the Kennedy brood, enjoying sun, surf, and rousing bouts of athletic competition. In the very limited text accompanying the photo essay, Bouvier indicated that while at the Times Herald, as she interviewed people in and around the halls of Congress, she and Kennedy had occasionally crossed paths. Upon their engagement, however, she claimed to be somewhat less inquisitive. "We hardly ever talk politics." From this point on, Bouvier largely was understood as apolitical. Popular media regularly framed Jackie as disinterested in her husband's politics, as though emphasizing that that was his preserve and not hers. When coverage did suggest a modicum of interest, it was very much in the form of Jacqueline as fascinated pupil or dedicated helpmate She would provide Kennedy with emotional support and encouragement, or serve as a rapt audience for his ideas and convictions, whichever style suited his needs or desires. His opinions, media suggested, would be hers. The Kennedy family, led by Joseph Kennedy Sr., had an astute understanding of and close relationship with American media, from film to newspapers and magazines with national reach. From his time managing Hollywood studios to his years as ambassador to Great Britain, Joe Kennedy, with his politically savvy wife Rose, had managed their family with an eye toward promotion and fanfare, with elite contacts in the world of politics, diplomacy, entertainment, and journalism. His was a family comfortable in front of the camera. So when John Kennedy wed Jacqueline Bouvier on September 12, 1953, theirs was not a modest event as initially imagined by Jacqueline Bouvier and Janet Auchincloss. It was a media extravaganza intended to communicate an idyllic romance between two beautiful young people who would from that point forward regularly appear on pages and screens across the United States. In its front page coverage of the Kennedy-Bouvier wedding, the New York Times emphasized popular interest in the union as it reported that a crowd of 3,000 persons, many of whom arrived in front of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Newport, Rhode Island, an hour before guests arrived, broke through police lines and nearly crushed the bride. In describing the bride and groom posing for their well-wishers after the ceremony, the Times reported that John Kennedy appeared with a grin on his face, while the bride appeared a little startled. Beyond the society fans, as Life magazine called those assembled outside the church, 600 diplomats, senators, social figures witnessed the wedding, and 900 guests attended the reception held afterward at the Auchincloss's Hammersmith Farm. In the text accompanying Life's photo spread of the event, readers learned that the wedding turned out to be the most impressive the old society stronghold had seen in 30 years. As one enthusiastic guest noted, "It was just like the coronation," referring to the June event Jacqueline had covered. Barbara Baker Burroughs, who later became a picture editor at Life, called the event a marriage made in heaven, the Kennedys and Life. Whether observers regarded the wedding as a royal affair, or the cementing of John and Jacqueline Kennedy as a national celebrity couple, Joe Kennedy succeeded enormously in his orchestration and promotion of the event. Jacqueline Bouvier became Mrs. John F. Kennedy, an identity that led her to be cast in a different light than the one she had fashioned for her Prix du Paris essay. Instead of an independent figure of interest in her own right, media framed her as a supporting player to her husband's professional ambitions. And this was true when it came to articles published in national periodicals, syndicated columns, and stories appearing in women's pages of local newspapers, and television coverage and appearances. In the early years of her union to John Kennedy, the press portrayed the far junior Jackie in a manner fairly typical for a young wife, linking her to her husband rather than recognizing the possibility of her autonomy, attributing her public significance to her husband rather than to any individual merit. Initially, she seemed to acquiesce to this image. In public statements for years to come, she would play to the notion of what it meant to be a dutiful political wife. But visions of Jacqueline Kennedy changed over the course of her public life. Inspired by shifts in her own life and sense of self, and also reflecting amended expectations of women as a whole, and the relatedly evolving means by which they were evaluated by American media. From the time of their September 1953 wedding through his eventual election to the nation's highest office, mainstream media asserted that John Kennedy's preserve would be the public, professional world, while Jacqueline Kennedy would focus on the private world of culture and character. Although, when possible, she would use these elements to assist JFK's professional advancement. Even before they wed, The two, media suggested, were prepared to fulfill the expected marital roles of their time and station. They would be partners, of a kind, but there were differences between men and women. Coverage further suggested that both were satisfied with their roles, and accordingly formed an idyllic pairing. Jacqueline Kennedy was, first and foremost, a wife. And then, in 1957, a mother, with all the obligations assumed of these roles. And for the remainder of her public life, media would return to these components of her identity and assess her largely by how dutifully she fulfilled these positions and their affiliated obligations. And yet the early years of her marriage and public life reveal something of her individual potential. Response to Jacqueline Kennedy on the 1958 campaign trail suggested the appeal Mrs. Kennedy held in her own right, and the means by which she might aid her husband's political career. While she had been a senator's wife for nearly 5 years, the 1958 senatorial re-election campaign was her first test as wife to a political candidate, and it was a baptism by fire. Traveling to Massachusetts regularly, JBK eventually joined her husband in 184 local communities. She gamely embraced the requirements of campaigning, even if the nature of the campaign trail was the antithesis of her reserved style. "I never can remember sleeping at home for however many months it was. 2 months, I guess. But you know, just running, running," she recalled of that time. When JBK addressed voters in the north end of Boston in Italian, William DeMarco, Boston district leader, recalled, "All pandemonium broke loose. All the people went over and started to kiss her, and the old women spoke to her as if she were a native of the North End. And I think her talk is actually what cemented the relationship between Senator Kennedy and the Italian-Americans of the district." As Kennedy's stalwart Dave Powers noted, "She was always cheerful and obliging, and to me a very refreshing change from the usual candidate's wife, because she did not bother to put on a phony show of enthusiasm about everything she saw and every local politician whom she met. The crowd sensed that, and it impressed them." By being herself, despite being very different from the typical Massachusetts voter, Powers suggested, JBK appealed to her husband's constituency. Powers further remarked, "When Jackie was traveling with us, the size of the crowd at every stop was twice as big as it would have been if Jack had been alone." The Kennedys' time was well spent. In 1958, JFK won re-election with 73.6% of the vote, breaking all records for the state, and winning a larger plurality that year than any other senator in the country. It was a victory of such magnitude, as Kennedy intended, that party leaders could not ignore it. A December 1958 issue of Time chronicled 6 likely Democratic presidential hopefuls, a list that included John Kennedy, as well as the hopefuls' helpmates. Jacqueline Kennedy was described as hailing from a socialite Republican family, and her education and early career warranted mention, as did the scope of their wedding, a big Newport blowout, and her position as mother to an infant daughter. Although she traveled with her husband during the last campaign, "Some days we would shake 2,500 to 3,000 hands," Time reported. "Jackie tried to avoid making speeches, prefers a homebody's life." This game willingness but natural reluctance increasingly would become a hallmark of public perception of JBK, and in some ways would feed the fire of public demand for more and more of her. But even as media often painted her as apolitical, she recalled, "People say he never talked about politics at home with me, but that's all that was talked about. While they may not have engaged in policy debates, he always talked at home of what he was thinking about, or people." From these discussions, Jacqueline Kennedy became increasingly astute in her understanding of relationships, image, and media in relation both to her husband's political ambitions and to her own navigation of public.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?